Eric was worried about coming up here and presiding for the first time, and he's doing okay. Now, it's always really hard the first time you come up and do it because you're not sure exactly how you're going to feel and how things are going to happen, but good job. If you have your Bible, turn to John chapter 11. And there's a couple things I want to say. We're shifting out of the series that we were doing that we called Hard Sayings of Jesus. And last week, to end it, we looked at the beginning of the story, which is Jesus hearing the news about his friend Lazarus being sick. And we looked at some things that he said in there. This week, we're finishing up the passage. We're actually looking at the miracle and what it means. And we're shifting into a series that we're going to do for the next couple of weeks just on Easter. I mean, for those of you who don't know, Easter's right on the horizon. It's a little bit different. It's not like Christmas where you say Easter's coming and kids go, oh my gosh, you know, it's not that kind of holiday, but it is a spiritually significant time. Obviously, as a church, we want to encourage you in the Easter season, the next week, 2 weeks, to really take some extra time to spend in prayer, fasting, meditation. And in that last week leading up to Easter, we're going to make a devotional available. We'll put it online, and we'll also send it out through email, whether it's the newsletter or just in general. And we want to encourage you to read through Sunday through Easter Sunday, through the parts of the Gospels that tell us what Jesus did on each of those days, and to really take some extra time just to privately think and meditate and pray over Jesus and what he's come to do, that he's come to live and die in your place. If you're not a Christian, I want to encourage you to go through those things also. It's a really good way to be able to see Jesus and what his ministry was about. You know, we could talk about healing, we could talk about teaching, but really his ministry culminates in his death and resurrection. So even if you're someone who's here today on just wanting to see what the church is like, I want to encourage you to go through that and see whether Jesus' claims are true, whether he really was the Son of God. And that's really the biggest question you're going to have to wrestle with. Again, we're going through a series, and even in the series, we're going to focus on Jesus' death and resurrection. And today we're going to do that through looking at Lazarus' death and resurrection. Very unique miracle. Very interesting account. And again, we started it last week. Last week, we read the section where Jesus receives the news that his close friend is sick. Just to remind you, Lazarus is a follower of Jesus, and his family's very close to Jesus. Matter of fact, you may have heard of Lazarus's sisters, Mary and Martha. You know, they show up in a lot of other parts of the gospel accounts, and we find out that Jesus had a very particular attachment to this family. But Jesus receives news that Lazarus is sick and that he is in the process of dying. And so last week we looked at it and we talked about death. We're not going to talk about death today, even though we see Lazarus' death. What we're going to do is, as we go through this, we're actually going to take this time to look at and hopefully to meditate on Jesus, on who he is, because this particular miracle is important. It's central. It helps us understand who Jesus is. And at the very end, we'll see what he's come to do. So as we look at this, we're gonna ask ourselves, what do we see about Jesus? Okay, what do we learn about Jesus? What does this tell us about Jesus? Okay, so that's the question we're going to be posing. The first answer to that comes in verses 38 through 44. So again, if you have your Bible, go to verse 38. I'm going to read. This is the tail end of the story, and this is really the miracle itself. Let me start in verse 38. It says, "Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave and a stone laid against it. Jesus said, 'Take away the stone.' Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, 'Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days.' Jesus said to her, 'Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?' So he took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, 'Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always heard me, but I say this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me.' When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come out!' The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to him, 'Unbind him and let him go.'" Now, the first thing we see about Jesus is the most obvious. the first thing we see is we see the power of Jesus. And again, we talked about this last week, but the Gospels are full of accounts where Jesus does miracles. He heals the blind, he heals the lame, he even casts out demons. And in ancient times, the ability of a particular healer was based on what he was able to do. You know, there were limitations to what a lot of these men could heal. If you met a miracle worker, for instance, there were some things he could do, some things he couldn't do. And depending on how powerful he was, depending on how close he was to his God, depending on how close he was to the source of his power, he could do or he could do more. He could do less. And there were some things that no miracle healers could do. For instance, if you remember, there's the instance in where Jesus heals a man who was born blind. And the reason why that's so important to know going into that particular story is that no one could heal someone who was born blind. They could heal things that were hurt in this world, but they couldn't heal people of things that they were born of because that was part of their creation. That was how they were born. That's the way they were made. And when Jesus heals the man who was born blind, people begin to realize that he's not just your run-of-the-mill miracle worker. He's not simply the guy who comes around and prays and things happen. They begin to realize that he's more powerful than anyone they've ever met, anyone who's ever made these claims. Here, Jesus is doing the same thing. This isn't just a miracle that he does and he says, ta-da, have your life back. I mean, this is death to life. And the thing that's striking is no one does this. No one can do this. You know, another thing that's striking is, and this is what makes Jesus unique too, is that a lot of miracle healers at the time, they would do miracles, but they would have to call on another power. They would have to call on a higher power. They would have to invoke the name of their God, or they have to do some ritual or some dance or some traditional thing in order to make something happen. And in all of Jesus' miracles, he never does he? He simply says to the storm, he says, be still. Simply says to Lazarus, come out. And it's interesting that Jesus never has to invoke a higher power. He never has to pray this incredible prayer where he says, oh, hear me and listen to me, and if it's your will, then please do this. Even in the prayer that he prays, he says, I'm just praying this so that they know. But Jesus never has to invoke a higher power. He never has to invoke someone else or something else in order to do the things that he does. And what he's doing is he's showing us his power. He's showing us what he is able to do. And the Gospels are full of miracles. And to some degree, part of their purpose is to show us that Jesus is powerful. He heals all kinds of diseases, all kinds of ailments. He's able to calm the seas. And here, towards the end of his ministry, he's even able to bring the dead to life. Now again, that isn't shocking for a lot of us because we know the gospel accounts, but it is shocking. It is absolutely shocking. You know, it means that Jesus isn't just a man. Now, let me tell you something else too, and I think this is why I wanted to share this, and this is a part of what's going on here. If you choose to become a believer of any religion, Christianity, Islam, whatever else it is. Let me give you a little hint, and hopefully this is helpful if you are seeking. If you choose to become religious, and even more than that, to become very strict religious adherent, it's important to believe in a God who's a powerful one. Okay, that's a very simple place to start. It's important to believe in a powerful God. It's actually useless to believe in a God who's impotent, who can't do things, who can't control things. And yet, some people believe in a God like that. They believe in a God who is loving and yet incapable. If you want your religion to matter, if you want it to count for something, believe in a God who's powerful. Believe in a God who can do something. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah? Well, we see in Jesus as he is. You know, he doesn't just sit back and say, oh, woe is me, I can't believe this is happening. So terrible, wish I could do something, my hands are tied. He doesn't. He says to the storm, he says, be still. He says to the dead man, come out, and it happens. Now, let me share something with you that's even more important. The truth is The truth is, most of us don't believe that God is very powerful. Most of us don't. And you can say, well, Pastor Young, how can you say that? I mean, you know, we see these miracles and we know. The truth is, most of us don't. And the way that I know that is, if you and I really believe that God was as powerful as he said, we would pray a whole lot more than we do, right? You know, there's a reason why we don't pray when people are sick, or we don't pray confidently when people are sick. There is a reason why we don't pray when things are crumbling around us in our lives. You know, there's reasons why we don't pray when things aren't going in a way that seem to be God's way. And inherently, in the very core of our hearts, we don't really believe that God is that powerful. We intellectually believe it, but we don't really believe it. And that keeps us from engaging God. You know, one of the things that I want to encourage you to remember as we launch into the Easter season is that the God that you believe in, the God that I believe in, is powerful. Not just in the Old Testament, not just in the New Testament, but he's able to do whatever he desires to do. And Easter is about that, isn't it? It's about God breaking into the world, changing everything about the world that we know. It's about the fact that Jesus, in his coming, in his life, in his death, in his resurrection, changes everything, and that God has the power to do that. He has the power to change the world around, and he also has a greater power, the power to change the human heart. And the gospel is about that. The gospel is about God coming to change you. And that's the most difficult thing he could ever come to do. God has come to change you. But that's the place the story starts. It starts with a God who is powerful. And even if you don't believe it, you need to believe it. You and I need a God who is absolutely, totally powerful and in control, who will act on your behalf, a God who can make things happen. That's what we see here. That's the affirmation. God is powerful. Jesus is powerful. So that's the first thing. And again, nothing new for a lot of us. At the same time, we really do need to believe that. Okay, that's where we start. Second thing this passage shows us is in verses 32 through 37. So let's go backwards. Look at verse 32, and this is what we see about Jesus. It says, "Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.' When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, 'Where have you laid him?' They said to him, 'Lord, come and see.' Jesus wept. And so the Jews said, 'See how he loved him.' But some of them said, 'Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?'" Second thing we see, and again, this is going to be obvious when you hear it, but it's very important. Second thing we see is we see the compassion of Jesus. We don't just see the power of Jesus, we see the compassion of Jesus. And this is actually a very important moment. Verse 35 tells us something very instrumental, but it tells us Jesus wept. You know, for those of you who want memory verses, you feel like you don't do a very good job memorizing scripture, that's a really good one. Jesus wept. And hopefully that plays a lot into other things. So I think for most people, now you have Jesus wept, John 11, and you have John 3:16. So you go from those two, kind of build on, and you can add some others on there. But it's a very important statement. You know, this tells us that Jesus isn't just kind of robotically going through the motions of what he needs to do. It actually gives us a great insight into the heart of God and the heart of Jesus. You know, what we see here is it reveals something. Now, you could make the case that Lazarus is a close friend, and he's a follower, and that's the reason why he was sad, and I think that is part of the reason why Jesus was sad. It shows us that here, the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, is compassionate. He weeps, you know, he weeps at the news that his friend has died. Now, something else is going on too, and I don't want you to miss this. There's another reason why Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, okay? And I want you to kind of get this. if this was only about Jesus and his friend, if the story was just about the fact that his friend Lazarus was sick and Jesus is able to raise him from the dead, Jesus would have come earlier, right? He would have heard the news, oh, Lazarus is sick. Jesus would have raced over, or from a distance, he could have said, you know what? I can do this from a distance because that's how my power works. He's healed. They could have made their way back and they could have heard, oh, wow, he started getting better the moment that Jesus said this, right? I mean, that's happened in different places too. This isn't just about Jesus healing someone because he's a friend. There's a subtext going on, and the subtext is this. Jesus is going there, and he's not just weeping over a friend who's passed away. He's weeping for another reason. There's actually another place that Jesus weeps. And for those of you who know the Gospels better, you kind of remember when this happens. We're told that Jesus goes up to a high place, and he looks out upon Jerusalem, and what does he do? He begins to weep. Now, what I think is happening there and what I think is happening here are the same thing. Jesus looks out at Jerusalem. He sees people who are lost, living as sheep without a shepherd, people who are in despair, and his heart is broken. Here, it's a lot of the same thing. Here, Jesus comes, and there are people mourning. There is someone dead in the tomb. And Jesus weeps. And again, partly it's his friendship, but the other part is this. Jesus sees this entire scene in front of him, and he begins to weep because in his heart he says, this is not the way things were supposed to be. Jesus weeps because in his heart he says, I did not create a world in which death was supposed to reign. I did not make a world in which people were meant to mourn. Jesus weeps because everything that he has created has been broken. He weeps because people weren't supposed to mourn. People weren't supposed to suffer. People weren't supposed to die. People weren't supposed to live in anguish. People weren't supposed to live in despair. And you see, he weeps because of that. That's actually, I think that's one of the reasons why he raises Lazarus. It's Jesus' way of saying, things aren't supposed to be this way. This is how things are supposed to be. And he raises him up. You see, miracles aren't just shows of power. They're also promises. They're also pointers. When God does a miracle, when Jesus does a miracle, it's his way of saying, things weren't supposed to be like this, they're supposed to be like this. When he heals a man who's blind, when he heals a man whose hand is withered, when he heals a man who can't walk, he's saying, things aren't supposed to be like this. You are my people, and my people weren't meant to be crippled. You weren't meant to be blind. You weren't meant to be infirm. You were meant to be strong. You were meant to live life in a way that was full of joy and hope. You are meant to be free. And so when Jesus does miracles, it's not out of pity. There's compassion to it and there's purpose to it. And so when Jesus heals this man, it's Jesus' way of saying, things were not supposed to be this way. Death was not supposed to reign. You were not supposed to die. We were not supposed to mourn. Things were meant to be better than this. And that makes him weep. And you know what? Here's the truth. All of us know that that's true. Life was not supposed to be like this. That's one of the reasons why the human heart always longs for a utopia. You know, we long for this place where things are perfect. And you don't even have to believe in God to believe that. You know, we have this longing in our hearts. We have this sense in our hearts that things weren't supposed to be like this, that there was supposed to be perfection, that there was supposed to be a way in which we lived in harmony, and that our lives were meant to be freeing and beautiful, and they're not. But you see, we have that embedded in us because it's true. And even the stain of sin can't wipe that away. And see, that's what Jesus weeps over. He weeps over the fact that it's not the way that it's supposed to be. You know, compassion isn't just Jesus feeling bad, because you can feel bad and you can show a level of kindness. Compassion is understanding. It's not just seeing someone who's sad and saying, oh, I feel bad for them. It's understanding the sorrow. You know, that's how compassion works in you, right? You can have compassion towards someone because you get their pain, you get their problems, you get where they are, even if you haven't been there. But you know, even in our existence, we have this saying. We say, you can't know unless you've walked in my shoes. Have you ever heard that? Like, you can never understand me unless you've walked a mile in my shoes. Well, Christianity and what the incarnation says, what Christianity says is unique. No other religion says this, but it says God has come to walk in your shoes. God has come to walk in your place. And because of that, God understands better. Jesus understands better than anyone. And you know, that's one of the beauties of Christianity. We can talk about other religions, and in other religions, the gods don't know. The gods can surmise, but they can't know. In Christianity, Jesus knows. He absolutely knows. He knows what it's like to be in a world surrounded, suffering in sin. He knows what it's like to see despair, to hear it, to see it in people's faces. He knows what it's like to meet someone who's utterly broken, someone who has no hope. He knows what it's like to see someone stuck in their sin. He knows what it's like to struggle with temptation. He knows what those things are like. And so when he sees people hurting, he doesn't just feign a kindness because that's what's supposed to happen. He understands. And you know, honestly, too many times we feel like he doesn't understand. We feel like he doesn't care. And again, that blocks us off from prayer. That blocks us off from loving him, from trusting him. But one of the really neat things that we have in Christianity is we have a God who understands, who sympathizes, who shows compassion because he's been there. Third thing that we see in Jesus, and we'll wrap up with this. Third thing we see in Jesus is in verses 38 through 44. We read some of it. I'm going to go back to a chunk of it. I'm not going to read the entire thing. But I do want to get to this little part. When you get to verse 40, Martha specifically comes up and says, don't take away the stone because there's going to be a stench, you know, and I don't know if you've ever been around someone who's been dead for 4 days, but there's pretty bad stench from what I understand. I haven't experienced it. I think the closest I've gone is, you know, I've dissected things that are soaked in that formaldehyde, but much, much different. You know, they didn't have ways of preserving bodies the way that we do. And what she's saying is real. Lazarus isn't feigning death. This isn't immediately after his death where maybe those people didn't have the technology and he just didn't happen to be breathing for a second or two. Lazarus is dead. You know, he's dead, whatever analogy you want to use, he's absolutely dead. Jesus says, take away the stone. Martha says, there's going to be this terrible stench. We shouldn't do that. And Jesus says this. He says, did I not tell you that if you believe, you would see the glory of God? And then when you look in verse 42, what he says is, at the tail end, he says, the reason why I'm doing this, he says that I'm doing this so that you may believe, so that they may believe. He's praying. He says, the reason why I'm praying this is that they may believe that you sent me. What Jesus is saying is he's saying that he's doing all of this to prove to the people who are there that he is the Messiah. He's not just some guy, but he is God himself, the Son of God, come to save his people. Now, I want you to notice in the entire story, this entire account of Lazarus' death and resurrection, what we learn about Jesus is we learn about the plan of Jesus. Jesus is very meticulous, and he has a purpose behind everything that he does, every move that he makes. So, remember, very first thing that happens is Jesus receives news about Lazarus's illness. What's Jesus' response? He waits. Why? Because there is purpose in waiting for Lazarus to die. It sounds cruel, right? It sounds cruel because Jesus could have gone, he could have rushed over there, he could have healed him really quickly, and then none of this would have happened. He could have, but he doesn't. Why doesn't he? And why does the account specifically tell us that Jesus waited, that he went to a different town, waited for a few days there, then when he got word again that he had died, then he went? Because Jesus was planning something. When Jesus does arrive there, he begins saying these very cryptic things. He says, "I am the resurrection and the life." In other words, Jesus has done all of this for a reason. He's teaching something. Saying, if you believe in me, then you will have life. Do you believe that? I mean, Jesus is very purposeful about that. And then even when he gets to the point of getting ready to do the miracle, he prays this prayer. He says, I'm doing this so that these people may believe that I am the person that I say that I am. I'm doing this so that everyone who hears this, everyone who sees this, everyone who hears about this miracle can see that I am the Messiah, that I am the Savior, that I am the one who has come. And what you see is that there is a purpose to it all. There's a purpose behind everything that Jesus does. There's a plan to all of it. And what Jesus is doing is intentional. He finally calls Lazarus, and Lazarus comes out. And it's this really, I wish I could see this. You know, Lazarus comes out, and he's draped in, you know, whatever they put on him. They bound him. He's not a mummy, so it's not like he's coming out like he's, you know, some kind of zombie or mummy. But he's definitely, you know, he comes out, and there's stuff on him. Usually when you would bury a body, you would cover it with a cloth, and you would there were wounds, or if there are infections, you would kind of cover that even though the person was dead. You would cover the body with different ointments just to prepare the body. And so here Lazarus comes out, and you can almost imagine him kind of like pulling these pieces of stuff off, kind of like, what happened? You know, where am I? And, you know, as I was thinking about that, there's part of me wonders what Jesus was thinking too. I mean, here Jesus knows that one day he's going to be in the tomb. But here, you know, Lazarus comes stumbling out. And in this entire story, we are meant to be reminded that Jesus has a plan. And the plan isn't just him raising Lazarus from the dead. It's much bigger. That Jesus is doing this miracle to show us what his miracle is going to be for us. See, this miracle is for Lazarus. Lazarus is dead. Jesus does the miracle. Lazarus is healed. Jesus is basically going to do this type of miracle again, but this time it's not going to be for someone else like Lazarus. It's going to be for you and I. And in this miracle, Jesus is going to die. And he is going to come back to life. Again, verse 35 tells us that he wept, and Jesus wept because his friend was dead. Jesus also wept because death was not supposed to reign. And you know, when Jesus came into the world, second person of the Trinity, Jesus smelled death everywhere. In heaven, there is no death. Heaven, the angels flitter around, the cherubim, seraphim, you know, none of that around at all. When Jesus stepped into this world, what filled his nostrils day in and day out was death. Every moment of every waking day. And all he saw around him was death. And in this particular moment, he experienced it. What it felt like to have a loved one die. And you know, the miracle of Jesus coming back to life is Jesus unraveling death, Jesus pushing death back for a moment, right? Death comes into Lazarus's life, and for this particular moment, Jesus pushes it back. You know, the interesting part about this to me is that ultimately, Jesus' miracle doesn't keep death from coming. We find out later on after Jesus' death that Lazarus dies. This isn't Jesus bringing him back to eternal life. This is Jesus kind of temporarily restraining death for a moment. And what's interesting to me is even this miracle of calling Lazarus out, ultimately can't hold back death. Because death is the consequence. It's the consequence of our rebellion. It's the consequence of our sin. It's the payment for our hatred towards God. But you know what's interesting is, unlike this, where Jesus stands outside the tomb and calls to Lazarus and Lazarus comes out, Easter is about the fact that Jesus goes in the tomb. And it's through his death that death is finally defeated. It's not just pushed back, it's defeated. You know, there's this great story about this man. I don't know how far in the past it was, but there's this great story about this man who was out camping in the woods in California, and woke up one day and he was kind of doing the things that he was doing on this little individual camping trip, and he heard this sound like a, you know, like thunder, like a tornado. And in California, you know, certain seasons they have these wildfires that rip through entire areas, destroy acres and acres, hundreds of acres of trees and fields that destroy homes and houses. And this man, this one particular day out in the woods, he heard this sound and he knew what it was. It was a fire, a wildfire coming. And none of us have been in that situation, but I mean, immediately when you hear that and you recognize it, you understand what it is, you realize that your death is impending. There's really, you know, there's almost no way to get out of its path because it moves so quickly, so ferociously that there's very little you can do. But what this man did was interesting. He actually, as quickly as he could, he actually roped off a section of the woods that he was in, and he created a controlled burn. And essentially, he had burned out an entire section of the forest for himself. When the burn was done, got into the middle of it, he laid down. The wildfire came, went through, and the firemen found him alive. Do you know why that works? Well, the fire doesn't burn up things that already burned, does it? And what this man did was this man found life by standing in a place that was already burned over. And you know, that's how Jesus saves us. That's how our salvation comes. Our life comes through his death because Jesus is that burned over spot for us. When Jesus does a miracle, he can push death back only for a little while, but he can't keep it from coming. And that's the reason why Jesus came to die. And in his death, we now rest in his death. And so when the fires rage and the fires come, when death comes to surround us, it can never fully take us anymore. Because in him, we have died with Christ. And in his death and in his resurrection, we live. And you know, today as we take communion, that's what we trust in. That's what we celebrate. We celebrate the fact that Jesus has come to die in our place, that he didn't just do a miracle to hold back death for a moment. We come to celebrate that in his death, we too have died. And in his resurrection, we too have come to life. You know, that's why the bread and the wine isn't just symbolism.